This is an ABC podcast.
How does religion shape you? It could be that it influences the number of kids you want to have. Or maybe the tradition you grew up with, but now find too onerous, sneaks into the things you say and even the values you still cherish. Or, as in our first story on the spirit of things today, you turn back to the tradition you once spurned in order to rebuild a life in tatters. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and all three stories take us into experiences of Islam in New Zealand, in Fiji, and here in Australia. Have you ever met someone whose energy and passion just spill out as soon as they start speaking? Mariam Chahab did when she visited a Sydney charity run by Shav Homsey.
So this is our office. Let me take you for a little tour. The office started in January. We realized that we needed somewhere for these clients to come, and all the guys that were in our program, recovering addicts, one was a painter, he came and painted. One was a carpenter, he came and put the walls up. And you know, another person was something else, another person was something else. Together, we were able to build this place. So this place is actually built by ex-addicts who helped us build the dream.
Shav Homsey is the co-founder with his wife Aisha of Giving Back Australia, a charity which runs a whole bunch of programs in Sydney, from drug rehabilitation to a women's support group and even a free grocery service to those in need. Run by a team of Muslim volunteers, their work has even stretched to Adelaide and the Sunshine Coast. I met Shav at his office in southwest Sydney late one evening. He didn't have much time to talk before he was due to see four drug-dependent users hoping to come clean. He explained why he and Aisha decided to set up the organisation in the first place.
We got sick and tired of seeing negativity about Muslims all over TV and the media. So we said to ourselves, why don't we do something different? Rather than, you know, get on YouTube or talk about, you know, Muslims are picked on, why don't we show the world through our actions what a real Muslim is and how you can be a true Australian Muslim? So we started Giving Back Australia, and we wanted to call it Giving Back Australia because we wanted to be proud Australian Muslims that gave back to the best country in the world. And we started it with simple food hampers. It was in Ramadan. And we just started a Facebook page, and we just put up a title, Do You Know Somebody Who Needs Help? And within 25 minutes from memory, five people contacted us that hadn't eaten in days. Well, that program is called Food Run, and we've been blessed strictly and purely through the generosity of people, because we take from Paul and give to Peter. We use the Robin Hood philosophy, but we don't steal it. That program now has evolved to a fortnight shopping, and we've got a state-of-the-art van that goes right up to people's doorsteps. That program, as of December 2017, has delivered a fortnight shopping to over 8,000 households.
For every food run they go on, Shav uploads a video onto social media showing the team preparing and packing the van full of food. You'll find more than 200 videos on their Facebook page. One person who's received help from the Food Run program is Bob. He not only got a fortnight's worth of groceries, but a new opinion of Muslims too.
Two milks,
yes,
Bob?
Yeah, give Bob two milks, mate.
What a top bunch of blokes.
Chicken or beef?
Doesn't matter. I don't care. You can only say, I got no groceries, I got nothing. See, what happened was my wife passed away. I haven't bought groceries for 6 months. Nothing.
You haven't bought groceries for 6 months.
It's the first time I've met Muslim people, and what a top bunch of bloody people. I just don't believe all the bullshit that you hear. It's all lies, mate. It's all garbage.
Free salad? Baked beans?
Thank you. I can't believe this. It's like I'm dreaming. If you would have told me that Muslims were going to be here helping me, I would have laughed at you. I would have thought they were here to blow my house up.
You got shampoo in there, earbuds,
That's over $100 more than groceries here. But this is incredible.
Right.
I don't even know how to say thank you. I don't know what to do. What a top bunch of blokes.
Thank you very much, Bob.
So what is it that drives Shav's passion to give back? Well, it all stems from his upbringing and a desperate promise he made to God during his darkest days.
I was born in St. George Hospital in the 70s and I grew up in Lakemba in the 70s and the 80s. Lakemba was just all Lebanese, or that's all I remember it of anyway. There was no racism, but Dad wanted more. So Dad come over here in the 70s with Mum when they newlyweds, when Lebanon was war-torn. They wanted a better life, so when they came here and had us, Dad raised us to be proud Australian Muslims, and he kept underlining the word Australia. So therefore in 88, he found the most Anglo area close to Lakemba, which was Reesby, and he moved us back there, and my God, was it a shell shock. There was no one around. You know, even people spoke English different to the way we spoke, and it was like, wow. And it was quite challenging because it was the start of the Gulf War. And everybody seen me, and it was the first Arab they've probably seen, and they would call me Saddam Hussein and call me different names and blame me for what was happening in Iraq. But, you know, we'd go home and complain to Dad, but he said, you need to go out there, son, and you need to show them that we're different, not by talking it, but by leading by example. And I think because of Dad saying that and teaching us that, it made me and my brothers and my sister to be the proud Australian Muslims that we are today.
And so what were your 20s like? I understand they were quite eventful for you.
My 20s were the beginning of my downhill, to be honest. I had my first child at a very young age. I think I was 19. And then I had a failed marriage there. And I got married again. Had another two kids to another Australian lady. So both my ex-wives are Australian. My kids are white with blonde hair and blue eyes. That was a failed marriage as well. And life was really out of track. So I wasn't really a practicing Muslim. I wasn't anything really. I was just a free-spirited gentleman who just wanted to have fun and enjoy life without thinking of the consequences.
And so on your 30th birthday, that's the day when you first tried drugs?
Absolutely. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was very anti-drugs, very anti-cigarettes, very anti-alcohol. I was anti-everything. And on my 30th birthday, I remember that day I was really depressed because naturally people on their birthday would like their family or their children around. Knowing that my kids weren't around was a very difficult time. So, you know, the boys took me out and we're in a hotel room and, you know, they're trying to, you know, out of love for me, snap me out of the mood and let me have a jolly good time that anyone would have on their 30th birthday. So when the boys realised that I wasn't having fun, one of them, who I forgive now, introduced me to a powder on a plate, and I honestly didn't comprehend what it really was. I've watched Scarface, but I never really seen anybody take drugs. So he said to me, just grab this note. It was a $5 bill or something rolled up. He said, put it in your nose and just take a big snort up and take this, and within a couple of minutes, let me know how you feel. To cut a very long story short, that spiraled out of control really quickly. So from that night, I went from taking drugs that time, and then I went to taking it every fortnight, then every weekend, and then it went to every couple of days, and then before I knew it, I was high every single day of my life for 5.5 years straight.
And was it just cocaine that you were taking at the time?
No, it wasn't, because with cocaine, you hang around crowds that take other things. So from cocaine, it went to cigarettes, from cigarettes, it went to whiskey. And from whiskey, being cocaine's a drug that makes you hyperactive, I needed something to settle me down and put me to sleep. And from there, I also got addicted to Xanax. So I was on all four at the same time.
And so what sort of impact does that have on your physical health and on your mental health?
At the time, I honestly thought nothing because, you know, for the ones in industry, we know now that when you're on drugs, your drug goggles come on and you can't see, it's tunnel vision. So I believe that I knew what I was doing, everything was under control and everything was hunky-dory. But in reality, I lost my beautiful connection with my amazing wife that I'm still with now. And I thank God for that because she's my absolute rock. I lost my connection with my children because back then, rather than spending quality time with them, I was spending money. And I was under the delusion that, you know, I didn't spend any time with them, but as long as I took them out for half an hour and bought them something, then everything was fine. I thought that my neighbours were police. I started hallucinating. A paranoia kicked in. I started thinking police moved into my neighbor's houses, police were watching me, police helicopters were on top of me. I would drive my wife absolutely bonkers with my paranoia.
So you say your wife Aisha was the reason why you got out of this period, but there was someone else that was very important to you as well, your dad. And I know you're getting emotional, but can you just tell me how he helped you?
My father came over here from Lebanon and he raised us the way he knew best. He was very strict and he thought that's the way to love. But God love him, at the time I really needed him is when I was on drugs and I was in big trouble. And what my dad did right is he became my friend. And I think looking back today, that really played a really big part. And I'm forever in debt to him for it. And Dad, I love you.
And you got a really important phone call from him. Do you remember what he said to you?
Yeah. My wife gave me a really long prep talk about how she wanted the man to stand by her and how she had enough. So I went out on the balcony and I was having a smoke and I was really sad. And it was Sunday. Between 9 and 10 o'clock at night, the phone rings and it says, Dad. I'm like, oh, God, what does he want? And he said, I just want to ask you one question. And I said, yes, Dad, in a really disrespectful voice. And he said, are you happy, son? And that was the million-dollar question. The best way I can explain it to people, it's like a steam train going a million miles an hour. It hit me straight through my soul, straight through my chest. And it became clear daylight through this pain that I was feeling that no, even though, you know, I was on drugs and it was band-aiding the pain I was going through, missing my children, but in reality, no, I wasn't happy because really it was only a temporary fix, but it wasn't a fix because it was actually causing me more damage than helping me in life.
And he gave you a set of instructions and one of those instructions was to talk to a doctor. Who was that doctor?
You know... Dad said to me, if you want to be happy, you need to talk to the doctor. And when I asked him who the doctor was, because I was very confused, being that it was, you know, really late on a Sunday night, Dad says to me, this doctor never closes his doors. He never stops listening. And he always answers people's prayers. And when I asked him who that doctor was, he said, this doctor is called God. And son, if you go right now and you pray to him, I can promise you that he'll be listening and he'll answer all your prayers.
And did you?
Yeah, I did. I went and done the ghusl that a Muslim does with water to cleanse ourselves prior to prayers. And then I prayed. And when I prayed, I remembered what Dad said. He said, when your head's on the ground, and when we're in the ground, us Muslims, we call it sujood. And when my head was in sujood and I said Subhan Rabbi al-A'la three times, which is what we do as a Muslim, that's when Dad said to me, stop and talk to the doctor. And when I did speak to the doctor, I made him a promise. I said to him, forgive me for what I've done. And I make you a promise that if you help me through this, I'll be with you forever. And this is my biggest inspiration for the ambition of when you first asked me, you know, how do you do these long days? It's because I'm working so hard to fulfill that promise I made to God.
Just for listeners who might not understand that phrase that you repeat three times, what does that mean in English?
Subhan Rabbi al-A'la, I'm pretty sure it means God, the most graceful, the most merciful. Along those lines, again, I'm still learning my religion because 25 years there was a big pause and only now I'm trying to learn, and the more I learn, the more I'm understanding how peaceful and how loving and how understanding and merciful God is.
Can you describe what it felt like when you made that prayer?
People are going to think I'm crazy right now, but at that time when I asked God, be with me and I'll be with you forever, I felt like the world's biggest needle. It hit me, injected into my body. It sucked out all my addictions and I could feel it while I was on the ground. And then it squeezed back in. A massive boost of energy that I'm still using today to inspire others to follow my example.
Does prayer still have that really powerful experience for you to this day?
Look, it does for me personally. I don't know what it does for others, but for me, I feel like it's a sense of meditation and time out. When I pray, five times a day as a Muslim. What it helps me with, if I'm depressed or sad about anything, I always go back to that doctor that my father told me about. It just gives me a bit of time out.
So you ended up going cold turkey, and then you made it your mission to really help others who were going through the same thing. You went and travelled the world. Can you just describe that process, like what happened after that prayer and after your mind shifted and your priorities shifted?
So for 12 months, it was really hard. And I'm a spiritual person. I wanted answers on why I was on drugs, what takes people to drugs, the effects of drugs, and how to get off drugs. And I didn't believe the answer was replacing a drug with a drug. So I went to many different rehab centres in Australia. Then I was privileged enough to go to South Africa to spend some time in rehab centres there. I later found out that in the Philippines, there's also some rehab centres. I went there and I went to Malaysia, amongst many other countries like New Zealand. And I was able to see different processes put in place at different rehab centres. And just sitting down and talking to the addicts, talking to the teachers and the doctors and the psychologists and the psychologists, social workers, welfare officers, in all these different venues, what method they were using. And then I found out what I went through and what all these places were using. And together, I was able to put together a program for Giving Back Australia. And the program is known today as Get Off Drugs.
Can you just describe how that works? How does the program work?
Look, in a nutshell, you know, at the start of the program, we run what we call the interview, where we sit with the, you know, if the guy's married with him and his wife, getting to know who he is and him getting to know who I am, so he gets comfortable. We also encourage the wives to come in, because that way we can identify, you know, if the wife is going through any stress because her husband's on drugs, or if the mother is going through stress, because that way we can also offer free counselling for them. Then we start arranging a six-week intense program where they come in, they get to sit with a qualified counsellor. From there, we teach them what their triggers are, teaching them the importance of identifying what their trigger is. That way, if they're ever put in that situation again, it reduces the chance of relapse. We introduce them into a healthy diet. Towards the end of the program, we start making a bucket list for them and know for the next 12 months where they want to be. We start setting the dates. So when we back off towards the end of the program, we get them to come in and see if they've achieved it. But generally, our success rate, again, with the permission of God, and the ones that want to give up, is very high.
Shaf's quest to understand drugs and their impact on people's lives took him around the world and led him to a key role in one of Sydney's biggest Muslim organisations. You're a funeral director for the Lebanese Muslim Association. You're around death all the time. Does that cause you to reflect?
Yes, it does. I actually, the only reason I am the funeral director is when I gave up drugs, part of my transition, I wanted to see what a drug addict that died from an overdose looked like when he was dead. Because we hear a lot of the Muslim preachers talk about, you know, the process of death and what happens when you're dying and the condition you die in. So I wanted to see that with my eyes. So I went there just intrigued and interested. And I became a volunteer. And then two and a half years later, I've been blessed as a funeral director. And it is really sad.
In Islam, we talk about the dunya, this world, and the akhira, the afterlife. And so you were literally seeing the two in one in that position. Is that right?
Absolutely. Like you were, because the Prophet ﷺ said, the way you live is the way you die, and the way you die is the way you face Allah. So as a Muslim, we believe that the way you live, the condition you live in is the condition you're going to die. And then if you die in that state, that's the way you're going to face God on Resurrection Day. Generally, the Arab culture, and the Greek culture, Italian culture, whatever it may be, the families have got a name and a reputation in their own community. And a lot of family automatically get defensive if one of their family members is on drugs and they want to sweep it under the carpet. One of the ways they do that is by threatening that family member, obviously like with goodwill, with good intention, because they don't know what to do. They've never been through this in the past. So they threaten them, just stop. and you're bringing shame to the family. And this is why I call it taboo. But I want to tell anybody that is on drugs, don't put your head down. There is ways to get out. The million-dollar question is, do you want to get off drugs? The answer to your problems is admit and submit you've got a problem and go seek help.
Wise words from Shav Homsey, the founder of Giving Back Australia. And Shav's mission to give back to society isn't just confined to his office or people's driveways. He takes his message to schools like Arcana College, an Islamic primary school in Sydney, that recently donated a year's worth of groceries for the Food Run program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Arcana College.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Guys, we're at the end of the Food Run program with you guys for 2018. Can I just say, we're not here to take your items. Our main focus here on working with your amazing principal and the teachers who put in all the help, and I want to say a big thank you, is to teach you guys a message. First and foremost, to appreciate the best country in the world. And what's that country called?
Australia!
Absolutely. We live in the best country in the world. And for the majority of us here, from what I understand, we're proud Australian Muslims. And we want to show the world through our actions what a proud Australian Muslim really looks like.
Hi, my name is Alia. I'm in year six and I'm school captain of Arcana College. I donated 10 packets of pasta, and me and my sisters, we donated tomato sauce for the pasta.
And why did you choose to donate?
Because Australia's given all these resources for us, so why not give back?
And how did you feel giving back?
I felt excited and happy because I knew that I did something right and that I knew that I'll get benefit from this.
Hi, I'm Saleh. I'm in year six and I'm the school captain of Arcana College.
So Saleh, what did you donate?
My sister donated it for me. She donated a couple of cans of soup and some rice.
And why did your family decide to donate to this cause?
Mainly because it's the right thing to do, and it's very good to always give back, and giving back is the most important thing.
Proud students at Arcana College in Sydney, speaking there to Mariam Chahab about their donations for the Food Run program at Giving Back Australia. You're with the Spirit of Things on RN. You can hear us online or subscribe to our podcast via the ABC Listen app. We just heard that Shav's faith was an important ingredient in his rehabilitation. In what other ways does religion affect life choices? It's a question asked by John Shaver, who's part of two big research projects funded by the Templeton Foundation in the field of the psychology and evolution of religion. He teaches at the University of Otago in Dunedin on the South Island of New Zealand, where I met him.
My project is interested in religious change and religious change in the modern era, and how religions impact decisions about how large to have your family, which, because those decisions have impacts on population growth and decline and what religion might look like in the future.
My guess is that the more involved you are in religious traditions, the larger your family size. Is that right, or is that a misconception?
No, that's generally the case, and almost all around the world, religious people have more children, and the more religious you are, the more children you have. There are some exceptions, and there are some dynamics such that religions that are in a minority tend to have more children, all else being equal, than children's in the majority. But your intuition seems to be correct. But what's interesting to me, at least, and part of the motivation for this grant, is that no one has really examined this problem from an evolutionary perspective. In particular, what brought me to this study was that large families are very costly for parents. We know, for example, that the more children that parents have, on average, it tends to affect them negatively. So a larger family, it's harder to send everybody to school, for example. But all else being equal, religious children seem to be okay. So there seems there might be something about religion or religious communities that helps to mitigate some of the costs of larger family size that doesn't seem accessible to secular families or families who are less religious.
So perhaps an example would be that a religious family that has a lot of kids, are you saying that some of those kids would be less likely to get involved in crime or gang behavior and, you know, dysfunctional behavior?
Perhaps. I mean, generally the evolutionary framework, the motivation that these studies come from, they don't really focus on things like delinquent behavior. But those are quite important. I mean, there's a difference between the teachings of religion and how those may affect morals and values and do so irrespective of the number of children. But in terms of things that have sort of more tractable biological outcomes that evolutionary-minded people like myself are interested in, things like wealth or things that more directly translate into things that will affect downstream generations, those things do not seem to be affected by large family size in religious families, but are in secular families. All else being equal, a child from born to secular parents who has two siblings will fare poorer than a child with two siblings born to religious parents.
Do you have any clues why that might be?
Well, that's actually what we're investigating. So I have a hypothesis, but I don't, you know, we don't have enough data to test these things quite yet, right?
I would also imagine that while being religious is one factor, the other might be where you are on the spectrum from conservative to liberal. For example, say liberal Jews might have fewer kids than Orthodox Jews. Similarly, liberal Christians might have fewer children than more sectarian Christians.
My suspicion is that you're correct. I think it is true, but I think it's like, I mean, there are differences in the ideologies between these groups, but generally conservative group members tend to have more involvement in the community itself. And I think really there's something about religious communities that are affecting child outcomes and family sizes. And to the extent to which liberal conservative religions are different, I think they're different in the involvement of the parents in the communities and the size of those communities.
Well, John, it sounds like a very interesting project that we should talk to you about when it's more developed. Let me ask you about another study you're involved in, and that is the New Zealand Attitudes and Values Study, NZAVS, yes. Which I gather thousands of people are involved in terms of being surveyed every year.
Yes, so this is a project that I'm lucky to be a part of. It was started by Professor Chris Sibley, a psychologist at the University of Auckland in 2009, and it tracks the same New Zealanders every year. And what's unique is that a lot of like large-scale studies, like the European Values Studies, they get data every year, but not from the same people. Right? So this study, the New Zealand Attitudes and Values Study, is unique because it tracks the same people over time. So you can see subtle changes in people over the lifespan or if there's a major event. For example, if New Zealand wins the World Cup, you can look at attitudes about nationalism or something like that in individuals over time.
How long is this study going to be going?
It was first, when Chris Sibley first developed it, he envisioned it for a 20-year project. And it's going pretty well. It is partially funded by Templeton as well. And it seems to be in good shape, thanks to Templeton. They just got another 3-year grant last year it started, I think. So it's very expensive because in order to mail surveys to 18,000 people, just the postage itself can be quite expensive. And then the people working on the project and things like that.
Gosh, I'm surprised they're using snail mail and not the internet email.
Well, we do use both, but there are still people in New Zealand who don't use the internet, and we want to be able to access them because their voice is just as important as anyone else's. And if we only use the internet-based survey, we would neglect those people.
Right, it would be skewed. Well, tell me about your section of it, which involves media coverage and Muslims.
Yes. So one of the things, when I first got started in the study, I had always been interested in the effects of religion and trust both within groups and across groups. So whether or not, for example, if I was a Muslim, if I met someone and I trusted them more if I knew that they were Christian, or if that made me trust them less. And so we did a few, along with Joseph Bulbulia, who is at the University of Auckland as well, we did a few studies where we looked at the drivers of prejudice towards Muslims in this country. And we were surprised to some extent that relative to attitudes towards other groups, prejudice towards Muslims was kind of high. It's not nearly as high as it would be in a place like the United States and less so than in Australia, but it was still kind of high. And it didn't make a lot of sense to us in the abstract because there aren't very many Muslims here. There's only about 1% of the population are Muslims, and there's been no conflict between Muslims and any other members of the population. So we began to think that, well, if there is prejudice, it must be driven by some outside source. And people had long suspected that the media, the international media, and the way that Muslims are portrayed in the media might be driving some of the prejudice. Because if you don't meet a Muslim and see that, you know, Muslims are just like members of any other religious group or just like secular people, they're perfectly fine. If you don't get the chance to meet them, then why would you dislike them? And we know that the international media tends to present a biased picture of Muslims. And quantitative studies actually done by researchers here at Otago of newspapers in New Zealand have shown that the media representation of Muslims in New Zealand is skewed negatively. So although people had long suspected that this skewed media representation would result in prejudice towards Muslim, it had never been demonstrated on a countrywide scale. So because the New Zealand Attitudes and Values Study is so expansive, we could adjust for all the other known drivers of prejudice. So we know, for example, that conservatives tend to exhibit more prejudice or report more prejudice than liberals. So we can adjust for a person's political ideology. And what we found was that the more people attend the news, the more anger they report towards Muslims and the less warmth they report. And what was interesting was that this happens across the political spectrum. So liberals tend to start out lower, but for each hour more of the news that they watch, they get angrier, which suspects that there's something general about the news that has this effect, regardless of the kinds of news you watch. So a lot of people would think if you watch a very liberal news source, still the way that the media are constructed to grab your attention through negative kinds of imagery and those kinds of things seem to be affecting everybody negatively.
Well, John, my experience is that media makes us feel bad about a whole lot of things, probably everything, because its job is to report about dangerous, abnormal, criminal acts that occur in the world today. So with Muslims making up 1.4 billion people in 59 Muslim-majority countries, and with a whole lot of warfare and suicide bombing every, few weeks, if it's not a Shiite shrine, it's a bus of kids, then my guess is that there's just a lot more bad news that people are seeing. And naturally, that makes them feel fearful about Muslims.
So you're right, there are all kinds of things going on in the world. But you pointed out there are so many Muslims in the world. Even though these acts happen, they're not representative of Muslims generally. But when you don't have information about Muslims from your general day-to-day life, the only thing you have as an example are these sort of awful things. But that's a sort of, our brains basically using the only thing that we know to make a judgment about a whole group of people. And we know that our brains also favor negative things over positive things when making judgments. So even if we showed a positive image of a Muslim and a negative image of a Muslim, all else being equal, we would tend to have the negative one just because we value negative images more.
Would that also hold true, say, for Americans? Today, everyone talks about Trump. Trump has a fairly controversial reputation, and there's a lot of anti-Americanism. Do you think Americans are also perceived through the negative coverage of Trump?
That's an interesting question. As someone who has an American accent and does not live in America, I feel like probably. I know after the election, I was here in Dunedin during the election. The next day, I was sort of embarrassed to order something at the store because I knew that they would think that I'm American. I think here, though, because people have a lot of interaction with other examples of Americans, although they're sometimes not much better than Trump, then I think that sort of lessens the effect of Trump overseas. It's not like Americans had a great reputation before Trump anyway. But I do think probably, especially, it's not just him, it's that people recognize that he has so much support within the country, so that roughly 30% to half of the country actually supports him. So that, to me, makes me, like me personally, kind of prejudiced against Americans myself.
Okay, well, you note in respect to Muslims that it's unclear what besides news coverage could explain the gap between acceptance of Muslims and the acceptance of other groups. But what about the appearance of Muslim women in hijab or jilbab or burqas? That's a highly sensitive issue for women, especially in New Zealand, where they were first granted the vote in the world. So are there cultural images that also cause some stirring of fearfulness or concern amongst, say, women?
I think in New Zealand, hijab or veiling of any kind poses a particular problem than in other societies. So the idea that basically everybody should be respectful of religion, but you should also not sort of impose it on someone else. So I think people here might interpret it as a sort of lack of religious freedom, in the sense that you're sort of showing yourself to be religious in a place where religion's okay, just don't bother me with it. So I think there's something about the sort of general tolerance, which ironically leads to finding it offensive. I can't remember the quote exactly, but I have this great quote headline from the New Zealand Herald, which is meant to be about the debate of veiling of Muslim women in New Zealand. But the two sides that are presented are both negative sides. So is it an imposition by men, or is it women who can't think for themselves, or something like that?
Yeah.
It's not whether or not these women actually want this, or it's an expression of their religious freedom. It's just what exactly is wrong with it, of these two bad options. I think here there's something about the individualistic, whatever you're doing is fine, just don't bother me with it kind of an attitude, that poses a particular problem for Muslim women here.
The ironies of intergroup attitudes, all plotted there by Dr. John Shaver, whose PhD is in anthropology, but whose interest is in the cognitive science of religion. You're with the Spirit of Things here on RN. And just before we leave, John, I wanted to hear more about this field of inquiry.
The field itself, the cognitive science of religion, emerged from a bunch of religious studies scholars who were sick of a lack of generalization and a lack of explaining within religious studies itself. So they wanted to, quote unquote, science up religious studies. Basically, it starts with the premise that, look, religion seems to exist in every human society. It's also quite old. So if you look at the archaeological record, you see evidence of religion dating way back. So the universality and the deep length of religion suggests that it's a product of humans, a human evolutionary history. So if it's a product of evolutionary history, then it must be rooted in our brains. And so to understand religion, we need to understand the structure of our brains and the way that brains develop. So child development is very important to the field. But the founders of the field also recognized that religion is much too complex for any one field to really grasp. So the field itself, so I just, as I said, returned from the conference. It's represented by anthropologists, psychologists, religious studies scholars, philosophers. It's a highly interdisciplinary project, and we all often work together on the same kinds of topics. So anthropologists will do field work, we'll do experiments, we'll do observations of children, all kinds of different things like that.
Well, the early 20th century looked at the evolution of man and generally thought that it would evolve away from religion, that it would be replaced by science. What's your view of that?
I don't think that's the case for a couple reasons. Just to sort of go back to the Templeton project that I'm working on, because religious people have so many kids, current projections show that although the world is becoming rapidly secularized, because religious people are having more kids, forecast in the next 50 years, this is the data from the Pew Research Center, more people will be religious in 50 years than they will now, just by looking at differentials in children. Moreover, in this country, although it's seen as sort of one of the most secular countries in the world, the New Zealand Attitudes and Values studies show that most people believe in something. So if you may not believe in God, you may not be a member of a religious denomination, but you at least believe in some kind of spiritual life force or something like that. And so although the nature of religion may change, may be less institutional religion and institutional boundaries and more sort of communal sort of borrowing of different religious elements, what it looks like will change, but I don't think it's going anywhere. So one of the major arguments for the reason why religion is a part of human nature is it helps us to build communities. And so although the institutional structures aren't there, the community importance and the unfolding of religion across the lifespan within religious groups is definitely still there. It's just different words employed by different disciplines, different categories of things.
And finally, John, can I drop this bomb on you? You're talking about the brain, you're talking about cognition, you're talking about the importance of religion. Where does God fit in this? I know that religious believers would say, look, the reason why it's always there and always going to be there is because God created us in his image, and therefore faith in God is always going to be a potential in potentia.
That is quite a bomb. When I first start out my classes, I teach a psychology of religion class right now. When I first start the paper out, I say people often think that science and religion conflict. And in some respects, they do. But science and religion are very different. So what I would say to such a person is the way the scientific framework I work in, it works by falsifying hypotheses, right? And so I cannot falsify that hypothesis that there's God. What I can do is I can do experiments on, for example, children, like how old are they when they start thinking there's a God? And what kind of bounds do they put on God's knowledge and things like that? And so you could do those kinds of experiments and they don't speak to the falsifiability of God. And my own intellectual work, I don't deal with those questions about the existence of God. I deal with the questions of humans' interpretation of God and how that develops and how that might be a result of the brain. That doesn't mean that, you know, God didn't put that machinery in our brains, but I don't work within the explanatory framework to be able to answer that question. It's just not what I do as a scholar.
John Shaver, thank you so much for speaking to me. I look forward to the results of your research in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for inviting me.
John Schaefer is president-elect of the International Association of the Cognitive Science of Religion. You can find him teaching at the Department of Religion at the University of Otago in beautiful Dunedin on the South Island of New Zealand.
Hi, I'm Zoya Patel. I am a Fijian Indian Australian. I've lived in Australia since I was 3 years old and in Canberra for the majority of my life, so I think I'm a Canberran also.
Zoya is a writer, and her feminist memoir, No Country Woman, prompted Siobhan Hegarty to find out how she managed her Muslim heritage, her identity, and her feminism in Australia.
Living in Australia, you grew up with your parents' culture, but also their faith. What role did Islam play in your life as a child and adolescent?
I think the role that Islam played in my life has actually changed over time. So it's almost happened in phases. So when I was a kid, it was just this really central part of our lives. Every evening we would do our Maghrib prayers together. All of us kids were taught how to read Arabic so that we could read the Quran in Arabic, which was this wonderful thing that our father taught us. He would sit us down in front of him. You'd kind of sit on his lap and you'd hold the book together and he'd teach you the alphabet. And it was just a joyful part of life. You know, we used to all pray together and we still joke about it because there would always be someone in the line who would giggle or something like that. And Dad's always been a really jovial person, so he couldn't help himself and sometimes he'd laugh. And those were the memories that I grew up with, this really happy part of our lives. And when we arrived in Australia, the main community that we had in Albury was this big multicultural group of fellow Muslims. So there were people there from Bosnia, from Malaysia, Indonesia, just all over the world, lots of Indians. And we all came together and formed this great little community with each other, and we'd pray in a local church hall and we'd go on picnics together, and Eid was like this amazing, you know, multicultural feast. I still remember all the women would get together on different weekends throughout the month of Ramadan and teach each other how to make food from their countries, which was just lovely. But then as we got older, the parts of Islam that I struggled with started to slowly kind of work their way into my life. So all of the joy and freedom of being a child, especially if you're a girl, becomes more and more constrained if you practice Islam a certain way, I suppose. And I think I was quite lucky because my family has always been very progressive in that. But even so, you know, gradually it was not being able to wear certain things. And then, you know, having to pray every night started to feel so onerous as a teenager when you already feel like everything in life is just too hard. I really was aware that none of my friends had to do these things that I had to do. So, you know, none of my friends had to go to the mosque for Sunday school. They never had to wear a hijab to visit certain family members or friends, or, you know, they didn't have to fast for Ramadan, which I always hated. It's not something that I felt connected enough to the faith with to get that positive aspect of it like my family does. And so I suppose it went from being a really positive force in my life to being a source of a lot of conflict. And I think the turning point for me was my dad actually went to Mecca and he did the Hajj pilgrimage. And when he came back, he brought a translation of the Quran in English, which I'd never read before. I'd only read the Quran in Arabic, but I don't speak Arabic, so I had no idea what I was reading. He gave me this translation and I started reading it from the beginning in English. And there was just a lot in it that I felt really fundamentally contradicted a lot of other beliefs that I had. So by that point in life, I think I was about 14, 15, I had a really strong sense of my feminist identity. And there is a lot in the Quran, and I understand that it's up for interpretation and, you know, different people interpret it and practice it in different ways. But for me, it didn't align with those other values. And I think that was kind of the beginning of questioning my faith and finding it very bittersweet when we had those wonderful kind of cultural experiences together with Islam. My family always had like wonderful Eids and I loved those moments, but I just always had this nugget of disconnect and fear because I could sense my faith kind of ebbing away. But it all came to a head when I was 18 and I finally came out to my parents as just not being strong in my faith and really feeling that contradiction. I think my dad said to me something like, it's okay, like it's not the end of the world. These are just journeys that we go on and, you know, go on that journey and see where it takes you. And I think they have always felt firmly that if you have faith, you have faith. And if you don't, then that's a path that you need to kind of explore and go down. But for me, I spent a lot of time that year and in the years afterwards just feeling very at sea. You know, you go from having a really strong sense of why the world exists and what your role in it is to feeling like this friend that you've had for a really long time is just kind of gone. So I think the role that Islam plays now for me is just an avenue into spending time with my family, but I haven't actively practiced for about a decade now.
Have other forms of spirituality or faith managed to fill part of that void?
I always struggle to talk about this because I don't think that we have a real understanding of or a way in which to talk about that agnostic faith that I think a lot of people like me who grow up with religion find themselves leaning towards, which is just a general sense of feeling like there is a bigger picture than the kind of very human lives that we lead and wanting to feel that connection more broadly to something. And I think that's the way that my faith feels or the shape that it takes now is just, I know that there's a very cynical, logical part of my mind that's like, nope, it's all made up. But then there's another part of me that's just doesn't want to believe that. And I sometimes, you know, I've said to my mom in the past, it's not that I don't believe in all of it. It's that the system of organized religion just does not fit with me at all. And I think there's probably a very private part of me that has a feeling towards the God that I grew up with. But in a way, I've almost deliberately not really sat with that for very long. I do think that faith, the way that it was taught to me in my family, is really a lot about family and a lot about respect and feeling and nurturing that connection to the people who matter to you. And so I think that's definitely still a big part of my life. And I do find myself kind of repeating things that my parents used to say to us, to my nieces, which definitely came out of their Muslim upbringing. So
can you think of an example?
So once I was watching my niece eat. This is my middle niece, Zara, and she's 4. She's notorious for asking for food, moving it around on her plate, and then saying, yeah, I'm done. I found myself saying to her, Zara, you have to eat every grain of rice because you don't know which grain of rice God has blessed for you. So if you miss one, you might miss that blessing, which is what Dad always used to say to us. And then if we didn't eat it, he'd take the plate and say, well, I might get your blessing then because I'm going to eat it. And I say these things to them and I have this moment in my mind sometimes where I'm like, but you don't even believe in that, Zoya. And then I think, but I do believe in the traditions that we grew up with and I do believe in making them feel connected and grateful for their food. Like to me, that's actually a lesson about being grateful that you have food and that that is a blessing that we are able to feed ourselves. And for so many members of my family, that was a genuine concern growing up, you know, will we have enough food? And that's something that I feel quite comfortable passing on to my nieces. But it is funny sometimes. I do find myself hoping that my dad doesn't hear that and think, oh, good, she's finally coming back to faith. You know, next minute she'll be coming to the mosque with us.
Zoya Patel, author of No Country Woman, was speaking to Siobhan Hegarty. To hear more about Zoya, head to the Spirit of Things website for a link to an online article. So, do you have any more clues about how your faith tradition shaped you and continues to? Thanks today to producers Mariam Chahab and Siobhan Hegarty. If you missed anything, remember to download us using the ABC Listen app. Next time on The Spirit of Things, we hear how an opera singer who was on the world stage celebrates the Jewish days of awe in song. I'm Rachel Kahn. I'll meet you right back here on RN.